Blog Talk Radio.
It's Tuesday night, and that means it's time for another episode of Stunt Tracks with yours truly, Uncle Jim, the one and only, D. Leslie Hoffman, and Admiral Ken. How you doing tonight, Ken?
Oh, just great.
It's going to be a good show. It's going to be fun, as always. We're going to meander along and see where this journey takes us. And of course, what would Stunt Tracks be without the Leslie Hoffman? How are you doing tonight, Leslie?
Oh, I'm doing okay. We've been having on and off interesting weather. One day it will absolutely downpour. The next day is pleasant. And then the following day, back to a downpour.
Yeah, pretty soon a downpour will be snow and ice right around the corner.
Dorian, the hurricane that was and wasn't and was and wasn't and was.
It just can't make up its mind. But we have a great show planned for you guys tonight. The last time we talked about alien species on Voyager, and the week before we talked about alien species on Deep Space Nine. So in keeping with our alien species entourage, we're going to move on or move back to TNG, Star Trek The Next Generation, and talk about some of our favorite aliens from TNG. Our phone number here is 646-668-2433. We will be with you for the next hour. It's currently 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, and we will be here until 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Once again, the number here is 646-668-2433. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call, and we'll get you on the air. So, anyways, I just want to say that next weekend is Star Trek The Motion Picture 40th Anniversary. It's going to be playing in several theaters, Sunday and Wednesday. I can't go on Wednesday, but I am going on Sunday, and Admiral Ken is going to be joining me at Crossgates Mall in Albany, along with a couple of friends from Freakopolis Geekery. We're going to be going to the 2 o'clock show at Crossgates Mall, and apparently this is going to be the original Star Trek The Motion Picture, and it's even going to have the interlude at the beginning before the movie played, not the interlude. Ken, help me out here. What do they call that?
Prologue.
They're going to have the musical prologue as it originally showed in the theaters. It's going to be all completely remastered, and we're going to get to see a special 40th anniversary making of the music type of thing. So that's going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. I never saw a Star Trek The Motion Picture on the big screen because I levitated towards Star Wars back then. Silly me. So here we are 40 years later. I'm going to get a chance to see the Klingon battlecruisers take on V'ger the way they were meant to be. I'm looking really excited about it. And we had Philo Barnhart on the show, 8-9 months ago. And he was one of the guys that worked on the practical special effects for that shot, for that scene. no CGI was used in that. It was all done practical with models and strings and ropes and wires and special effects. There was no computers. So I'm looking forward to seeing how it upholds on the screen today next to some of the great movies that we have out there now. I think it's going to be really fun. And I want to make sure you tune in to Trek Talking on Thursday night. We're going to have Matthew Carl Earl on with us, and you're saying to yourself, well, who's that, Uncle Jim? Well, funny you should ask, because I'm about to tell you. He is the guy that composed the music for the Dave & Buster's VR experience, Star Trek Dark Remnant. I had an opportunity to play it 2 weekends ago when I went up to Trek Conoroga. Well, I played it with J.P. Carden at Crossgates Mall at Dave & Buster's, and it was so much fun, and we talked about it on the show, and I was lucky enough to find Matthew and say, hey, you want to come on the show and talk about composing the music for a game and what it was like and working on Star Trek? So he was more than happy to do so. And that's going to be Thursday night, 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Same bat line, 646-668-2433. Give us a call. Ask him about the game. Ask him about the music. And if you're the lucky caller, meaning the first caller, you can pick up an autographed copy of Mirror Broken from J.K. Woodard. I keep getting that wrong. Is it Mirror Broken or Through the Mirror? I think it's Through the Mirror. Anyways, issue number one of the Mirror Universe comic book, signed by J.K. Woodard himself. And all you have to do is call and ask Matthew a question, and you win a free autographed copy of issue one of Star Trek Through the Mirror. I think it's Through the Mirror. Very easy, very fun, very simple. Check that out. Also, we are now available on iHeartRadio. That's right. You heard me right. Trek Talking is now available not only on iTunes, but also iHeartRadio. So check that out. If you listen to your podcasts on your phone or mobile device, you can also find us on iHeartRadio as of this morning. I think we're there as right now, aren't we, Ken? Did you check?
I didn't get around to check, no. But like I said, not to mention also, we are also on Spotify.
That's right. We've been added to Spotify as well. So our listenership is growing, and we just want to make it as easy for you guys as possible to listen to the Leslie Hoffman sharing her awesome behind the scenes and backstage stories with us. And speaking of which, we're going to dive right in right now to TNG. We're going to talk about aliens. Now,
well, actually, we're going to make a right-hand turn for a moment, because if you're going to go see the movie, when they're, what should I say, flying to see the Enterprise in dry dock, whatever you want to call it, there's a man in an orange suit that's floating around. And then also when the Enterprise starts leaving the dry dock, he does, I forget if it's a front flip or a back flip, that's Tom Morga.
Then really?
He's also the Klingon standing up next to the captain. And then he doubled Leonard Nimoy. And in the, I think there was a ship shake. And then there's, you know, where he is flying into Vigor or whatever. That also is Tom.
Now,
Tom is throughout this movie.
When V'ger, I've often wondered this, and now I have an opportunity to ask it. Speaking of Tom, since he was the guy in the orange suit and all the other scenes, when V'ger gets to Epsilon 9 space station and destroys it, we see an exterior shot, and we see the space station being enveloped in the blue lightning bolts of V'ger, and we see a guy in an orange suit go flying by, and it looks like he hits the camera at the last second. As V'ger absorbs him. Is that Tom Morga as well?
I would have to ask him about that. Like I say, I know he's definitely one of the workers working on the Enterprise in dry dock. I don't know if that was him in the scene you're describing now. I mean, actually, I should really try to bend his arm, and maybe I could get him to come on for an hour next Tuesday.
You know what? That would be excellent, because we're going to be having next week, is going to be our Star Trek The Motion Picture celebration. We're going to be talking. We are going to have Andy Bray and John Lim on. They have a big announcement to make. So they're going to come on. And then Sulu and Chekhov are going to join us for the rest of the show. And they're going to talk about their V'ger mission. And you'll have an opportunity to talk to Sulu and Chekhov in person. Now, last time they were on the show, we didn't get them on until the end, but we had a lot of fun talking with Sulu and Chekhov. So they're going to be back to talk about, you know, their experiences with V'ger and getting back together with the crew, being back on the Enterprise, the new Enterprise for the first time. So we're going to do that next week. So it'd be great if we did a Stunt Trek as well, and we could have Tom on to talk about Star Trek The Motion Picture, because that's the 40th anniversary. That would be awesome.
Yeah. Because a couple of other things was they actually filmed the scene where I think Spock was floating. They filmed it for like 2 weeks, and then they decided they hated everything and threw it out, changed costumes, they redesigned everything, and started over again. I mean, I'm sure this movie ran over budget. But the other thing, I wasn't there, but Tom told me this story was, and I don't remember where it is in the movie, is that there's like this fireball or something that comes down the hallway. I don't even know what hallway we're talking about, but I guess it was a bigger blast than they expected, and the special effects man comes out. It almost is like one of these comedy television shows. The special effects man comes out, and you know he's like covered in dirt. You know, luckily he didn't get burned, but he definitely got slightly singed. And then if I can find it on my computer, when Tom was dressed up as Spock to be on the Enterprise, that's when I went to Paramount with my camera, and we have this absolutely wonderful picture of Tom standing in his dressing room, and there's a mirror next to him. So the camera, you know, you can see half of his face, and yet you can see the reflection of the other half of his face in the mirror. And like I say, he's dressed up as Spock. So I'll look for that after the show.
I know, as usual, if you guys have ever listened to Leslie and I, when we start talking, we tend to meander. And I think that's the uniqueness of the show, the way Leslie and I do it, is we meander a lot. And I think that's what attracts fans.
So
they
now,
like
now
the show.
Now we can get into aliens, next generation.
I wanted to talk just a little bit more about Star Trek The Motion Picture, just a tad, because I love this. It's not my favorite Star Trek movie, but I really do like it. It's like 2001: A Space Odyssey. I have to be in the right frame of mind to watch Star Trek The Motion Picture, because it's not the most exciting movie, but it does have the best opening sequence I've ever seen in a film, and that's the three Klingons attacking V'ger, just absolutely top notch. And as I said, Philo Barnhart was on and told us all about the hours and hours and hours they spent putting that scene together, and I love it. I think it's when you hear the artists talk about how they made those scenes, they didn't just sit at a computer and do it out. They had to do it all with wires and pyrotechnics and everything else, and it looks absolutely spectacular. I'm so excited to see it on the big screen. But the one thing, Star Trek The Motion Picture went way, way over budget, tremendously. I think double the budget that it was meant to have. I think $46 million is what it finally came in at, and they just kept doing reshoots.
Well, I'd say, when you film for 2 weeks and then you throw out all that film and you know, the actors' contracts, I mean, you're paying the actors for two more weeks, you're paying crew for two more weeks, you're rebuilding everything. I mean, like I say, they even did costume changes. That's how much they hated the first 2 weeks of filming.
And we'll never see it.
Another thing is everyone keeps talking about Wires, but again, having that Tom is my friend and all that. Maybe they had Leonard Nimoy and Shatner on Wires, but they had this pole stuck into the side of Tom's costume, and that's how they rotated him going through space, and it was painful. I mean, being on Wires can be painful, but having this thing that's holding up your body, you know, stuck about waist level and rotating you, I mean, there's no way you can comfort yourself. I mean, I'm sure they didn't even think of it, is that, you know, they had put like a box down there that in between shots he could have, you know, stood up, but they're just having him hang by his waist on one side. At least on Wires, you're held up, you know, equally on both sides. But again, this was a pole in the side of his body.
Well, this we're talking about so far. We're everything we're talking about is the beginning of the movie, which is pretty cool. But one of the things that they did in Star Trek: The Motion Picture was the first time that had ever been done, and it cost them just a fortune to make this particular effect happen. And today, it's just common. We see it all the time, and it's just a common effect. But back then, it had never been done. And that's the scene when Scotty flies in the shuttlecraft around the Enterprise, and we actually see Scotty and Kirk inside the shuttlecraft with a rear projection, and we see the Enterprise outside. Today, they do that very simply, but back then, it wasn't very simple, and it cost them a lot of money. They were going to cut that scene out of the movie, and they ended up leaving that in the movie. And that's, I think, when we see them fly around the Enterprise, to me, a lot of people complain about that scene, but you know what? I think that the Enterprise has always been as big a part of Star Trek as any one of the characters. And coming off of a 60s TV show, to make this beautiful model of the Enterprise and not show it off would have been a total sin. So when they fly around the Enterprise for 3.5 minutes and we get to see the warp nacelles and everything's on the ship that we never saw before, with the level of detail that was not possible on a TV show, just awesome. Bring Star Trek from a cheap, campy TV show to a major motion picture in the blink of an eye. So I'm really looking forward to it. What about you, Ken? Did you ever see the motion picture in the movie theater originally?
Trying to remember. I mean, it was so long ago. I don't recall. I do, however, as I said, one of my favorite jokes was when I had the director's cut on VCR. I do remember one of my favorite stories that I managed to be able to go to the market and back while they were traveling through V'ger.
Yeah. And
I had to go to the market, and the movie was dragging on, and I said, I got to go to the market because if I don't get this done, I don't get it done. So I just kind of like, okay, this sequence is starting. And, I mean, I swear that when I got back, they were just finishing up. So, you know, I mean, but again, if you understood the director, Robert Wise, you understood that he was another one of those who never did anything small. He was also the person who did The Sound of Music. You know, he was not known for doing small pictures.
No, and that right. Particular scene with V'ger, today that would all be CGI and they'd whip that off in a computer, but back then it was all hand-painted glass, every single scene. Beautiful. I can't wait to see it. So anyway, Leslie, you must have gone to see the motion picture originally.
Yeah, I don't know if I went with Tom or I definitely saw it in a big theater.
Yeah, I'm looking for
I don't know if you were. I don't know. Well, why I say this movie's now 40 years old, is that I just thought they took the episode The Changeling from the original Star Trek series and made it into a movie. I mean, it's the exact same thing. Is that, well, I say, I don't know how to give the plot away if somebody hasn't seen it before. But if you've seen the episode
after
The 40 Changeling
years,
from TOS,
I think
exactly
we're safe.
What
if
the
some,
movie is.
If they haven't seen it after 40 years, I think we're outside of spoiler alert.
Well, okay, so then should I... In other words, in the episode The Changeling, it was this... I don't know to call it a... I mean, it fit inside the Enterprise, but what happened was it had been damaged, and then it was like these two satellites, whatever you want to call it, repaired themselves and became one, where, you know, the Changeling, I forget exactly what they were supposed to be exploring, while the other one was trying to get rid of any bacteria or something like that.
Leslie.
When they became one, the Changeling decided that inferior things, you know, should be erased. But it made a mistake. It thought, well, now I'm going into the whole episode, is it thought that the creator's last name was Kirk, but it made a mistake and it thought Jim Kirk or James Kirk was the creator. So that's why it didn't kill, you know, Captain Kirk. But anyway, so I mean, this whole thing on V'ger is exactly the same thing. It's two satellites that somehow crashed into each other and became one.
That was, I believe that was Nomad, if I remember correctly.
Right. Well, I think the episode's called The Changeling, and you might be right that I don't know if it called itself Nomad or whatever, you know, but it, like, he erased Uhura's mind.
Yep.
You remember?
Right.
Well, I don't know.
See, and one thing about the Star Trek movies is that they never end them. You know, they always, like, they never come back. Like, for instance, at the end of the motion picture, when Will Decker melds with V'ger and creates a new life form and turns into a giant flashlight and disappears, that's the end of it. We never found out, or ever through all the history of Star Trek, what actually happened to Decker and Ilaiya and V'ger when they became one sentient being. It's just, okay, they're gone. Next movie. You know, Rathacon comes along. They design this device, this planet-ending super genesis device that can wipe out an entire planet or make a planet. Again, movie comes and goes, genesis disappears. It's never mentioned again, it just goes away. And the whale probe just goes away. The Klingon homeworld explodes in Star Trek VI, while Praxis explodes, contaminates the Klingon homeworld. And in 50 years, they're all going to die. So obviously, they evacuate the planet. So what we see in the Next Generation is Kronos. Obviously, isn't Kronos. But again, the Federation just flies away, and we're left wondering what happened to the Klingons. They never tell you. So, you know, the movies were really good at bringing up these humongous, you know, intergalactic problems, and then just saying, "Oh, well, okay, we're done," and leaving.
Yeah, good
which,
story.
You know.
Let's do something else now.
So
yeah, that's what made it so unusual when you had Wrath of Khan and Search for Spock, where you had a bridge between Spock being, you know, dying and being sent to the planet, and then the next movie they picked him up again. I mean, that was pretty much the only set of movies that actually had any kind of a connection at all.
Right, it's
well,
a continuation.
Star Trek IV kind of continued that too, 2, 3, and 4. So, Next Generation, the very first alien that we meet on Next Generation, well, technically, is Deanna Troi. And this is in the early years when a Klingon warship would decloak and she would say something really super massively deep and intellectual like, "Captain, I sense hostility." You know, like, Klingons are hostile? Say it isn't so. And these were the early days before they fleshed out her character. And she used to wear a little mini skirt at first. And then they moved her into like a pink cat suit type of thing. And her costume had changed many, many times. And eventually she ended up in a blue Starfleet uniform like everybody else. But it took a long time. But her, to make her an alien, they did the simplest thing, Leslie.
Right. They just put in solid dark color contact lenses. And that made her a Betazoid. There was no other variation on her features to make her an alien.
Nope. Just black contact.
Yeah. And then her mother, Loxana, is that how you say it? These names tonight are going to be fun. Loxana Troi, Majel. I gotta go from Next Generation to Deep Space Nine. She had the greatest costumes, and she had a really good character. That was a marvelous character. I mean, she could be serious, and she also could be the comic relief. I mean, that's how talented she was, or how well they read or they wrote the scripts for that character.
She, you know, Loxana was always kind of a flighty comic relief type of character, but in Deep Space Nine, the scene when she's going after Odo and they get stuck in the turbo lift and she takes off her wig and you find out that she's practically bald and Odo is starting to flake and melt and he has to turn into liquid, and she comforts him and lets him turn into liquid and supports him in her dress because the Cardassian lifts are surrounded in electricity and he would just drip down the grates and be electrocuted. That scene, like you said, really, really showed off Majel Barrett's acting ability and also gave Loxana Troi a chance to be a really serious, dramatic character rather than some flighty comic relief. It's a brilliant scene.
Yes, absolutely.
And Majel Barrett was a treasure. If you ever had a chance to meet her at a convention, she was the most honest, open person. She loved the fans. She loved Star Trek. She was awesome. So, anyways. So, we also, another alien that we meet on the Enterprise is Lieutenant Worf. And, of course, he's a Klingon. And but he's a Starfleet Klingon, so he's not all that bad. One of my favorite characters, the character that got me interested in Star Trek. And Michael Dorn. Now, Leslie, Michael Dorn, I'm sure that when they started doing The Next Generation, it took them hours to do Michael Dorn at first, I'm assuming. You know?
Well, I don't know if it was. It could have been hours, but by the time he got to Deep Space Nine, Klingon makeup and hair, maybe an hour and a half.
Yeah,
and
because
I've brought this up before, is that the other thing about Michael Dorn is he does not have that build. They had to create a muscle suit for him.
And maybe I'm showing my ignorance here, but when I went to a convention to meet Michael Dorn, the first time I met him, and I dressed up as Michael Dorn, as Worf, and had him sign my picture for me. Well, when I went up there to meet him, I was totally shocked that he was black. And I thought it was just an awesome makeup job that they did on the show. But in reality, when I met him, and he was actually black. And I was like, wow, I just thought that was an awesome makeup job. Silly me.
I am not very mad.
If you got to remember, that was before Eddie Murphy, you know, did that whole thing for Coming to America, where he got turned into a white guy. And so I was just like, wow, I thought that was just an awesome makeup job. Huh. Silly me.
Oh, yeah, that. Are you talking about the last scene where, well, I think the last scene where he tells the joke about the soup and the spoon. Rita, I can't eat the soup. What,
yeah,
is it too hot? No, it's not too hot. Is it too cold? No. Well, you know, why don't you taste it? Where's the spoon? Ah.
That's the scene I'm talking about.
I did not know that was Eddie Murphy. I mean, I think they revealed it in the credits.
Yes. Yep. He was awesome. So, you know, there's another alien that we see on TNG for the first time.
Oh, well, wait a minute. Let's finish off. So the other thing, I was looking at older pictures, and it's interesting because, well, you know, in the original Star Trek, they just used makeup. There were no ridges on the Klingon, but the ridges were different. They were almost like coming up in a peak in the center of the forehead. It was completely different than what Worf evolved into and the Klingons that you saw in Deep Space Nine.
Yes, because speaking of the motion picture,
also,
again, we'll go back to Tom Morga. Those Klingons that when Tom Morga was a Klingon in the motion picture, they originally, their spine came up the back of their head and up over their head, back of their neck and over their head and right to the tip of their nose. And they were spinehead Klingons. And that's how the motion picture Klingons look. And they evolved that to Star Trek III. And they went to a simpler makeup, which we see Doc Brown wearing in Star Trek III. And then when Next Generation came around, they refined that even further into what we see Worf wearing. And then it changed even again by the time you got to Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. Also, early on with Worf, he had, what should I call it, human teeth or regular teeth? But they decided that Klingons should have pointed teeth, so suddenly he has pointed teeth. I think there's an episode where he actually sharpens his teeth. But any Klingons you see, like I say in Deep Space Nine, they always had those pointy teeth.
And they were always rotten and black and. I don't know.
Right.
Let's not forget, Worf loved his prune juice.
I protest.
So
I am not a merry man.
But
he loved his prune juice.
I'd like to just an actress that I really love, and she actually played other characters too. Is Susie Plankton, was half Klingon,
awesome,
half human. But she sure didn't look like Torres. You know, Torres was half Klingon, half human, and it was totally different makeup, you know, from, and I don't even, K.L., go ahead, you can say the name.
That's K'Lar.
K'Lar, okay. I mean, I was so impressed with her in the first episode she was in Next Generation. I felt they could have done a spin-off series on just her. That's how good I thought she was. And I almost wonder if they killed her off in the second episode just so the audience or the fans would say, we want to see more of her.
And you know what? She's my favorite Klingon. I loved her character. And when they killed her, I couldn't believe they killed her. But if you look at that episode, it was the right choice to make, because Kalar had to die in order to push Worf over the edge to kill Duras. That was the only way to get him to do it. And it worked perfect. It worked beautiful, actually. But I hated to see her go. But that wasn't the end of her, because we did see her again, because she played a Vulcan as well.
Right. And here we go again. Vulcans, it's just the eyebrows and the ears.
Yep. But then she came back on Voyager as a Q.
Yes. Yes. That was between John Delancey and Susie Plankton, that was a show in itself.
And that was the one where they're trying to create new Q, because Q is running out of Qs, and they're trying to to get Qs, and
yes, capital Q,
they find out
lowercase Q.
How are we going to do this? And Janeway's like, the old-fashioned way, and they're like, you mean sex? Ooh. So Susie Plaxton and John Delancey had to go off and do the nasty in order to create more cues, I guess. They never came back and revisited what that looked like, what their offspring cue would have been. We never got to see that. You see, this show is so awesome because we go everywhere. Nothing is off the table.
I know. It's a good thing we're not driving the car. We'd be all over the road.
But I think that's what people love about our show. We're just so free-flowing, and you never know what we're going to say. Hell, we could talk. We could go off on a tangent about Planet of the Apes at any minute now.
Right, exactly.
Thus is one of the nice things about not being...
You know, that was the whole thing with the Planet of the Apes, is that they blacked out the human teeth and then had the ape teeth in front of it. And you watch a movie nowadays, and, you know, you can see this row of black teeth behind the ape teeth. But this is 1968. I mean... You know, you have to start somewhere, and like I say, you keep evolving. But I'll take the original Planet of the Apes over the remake any day.
Now, Leslie, would you consider Data an alien?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, which one?
Lieutenant Commander Data, is he an alien?
Well,
kind
of. I think he deserves an honorable mention because, you know, originally they're saying he's an android, so that doesn't make him an alien or species. But then they had that episode where I don't remember the guy's rank or title, but it was that Starfleet decided that they were going to take Data apart. They were just going to, I'll call it, eminent domain him and take him away and take him apart to see how he works. And Riker was selected as the lawyer representing Data to prove that he was a sentient being, and he won. So now
the question is... Yep.
Go ahead.
Measure of a Man episode. Is what that was.
Right. So if they proved that an android was a sentient being, does that make him a species?
I would say yes. What would you think, Ken? Absolutely yes?
Well, also, yeah, the other factor you have to come into account with this is that, okay, even if he's an android, he's an android that was built on another planet.
True. That makes him an alien.
Oh, he wasn't built on Earth, so you sort of would have to kind of default the said that he's, if not an alien, he's at the very least alien technology.
And let's not forget, he did attempt to procreate when he created an offspring in Lal. So
yes.
I think that makes him a species.
I would
agree.
It's just one of the, you know, it's like going back to TOS. It's like the Horda. I mean, that was a sentient being, except it was carbon-based, or am I getting my minerals mixed up?
Mineral-based, yeah.
Silicone, I think, wasn't it?
Silicone, yes.
So, you know, silicone. At first they're saying this isn't really a being, but they just never met that type of an alien before. It was a sentient being. See, now we just jump back to the original.
See, we just meander all over the place. We got 50 years to play in, so.
so you know, Data's again. To make him an android, they just did white makeup and yellow contact lenses. And he was an android. Ta-da! You're an android.
Now, Leslie.
The interesting thing was the stunt double for Data was Brian Williams, another friend of mine. And I guess they just never felt that it was worth the expense or putting contact lenses into his eyes. So every time that Brian doubled Data, he did not have the yellow contact lenses. I mean, I guess if you're doing a stunt, things are going so quickly that I guess you're not going to catch the eyes being the wrong color.
Now, Leslie, I was totally surprised when I went on a tour of Paramount back when they were doing TNG. I think this was 91, maybe. And I went to the Karen and I went to the commissary there, because if you're going to go there, you want to eat there, right? And who comes strolling in but Riker, Data, and Geordi. And I say Riker, Data, and Geordi because they had on their Starfleet uniforms, the whole nine yards, and Data was gold. And I wish I had a camera, but they weren't allowed on the set. When I saw Data and he was gold, I was like, wow, he looks white on TV. But in reality, he was more of a gold color when you see him in person.
It could be. I'm not disputing it. I mean, I agree with you. By the time it was on film, he sort of, if you had to say what color was Data, you wouldn't say gold, because to me gold is such a solid color. But we're back to the bat lifts and all the weapons. You think they're made out of metal and they're made out of rubber.
Exactly. I mean, what you see on the screen is not exactly always what is really in front of you.
Yeah.
Now, what about, since we're on TNG, how about those space jellyfish that they release from the planet, from Deneb 4? Those are definitely aliens, I would say.
I don't have every episode memorized.
Because Deanna Troy says,
now you have me curious. Well, if they were jelly, were they models or I don't remember the episode. Sorry.
I don't know, Ken. Were those? They had to be models because they didn't have CG back in the '80s, right?
Right.
Yeah, well, like I said, the first episode was Encountered Farpoint. Yeah, they could have done it with animation. Yeah, I mean, you know, they could have done it with animation. They didn't have CGI, but they still have the ability to make, like I said, animation. So they might have been, you know, kind of like a cartoon. I don't know, or something along similar along those lines. I mean, a lot of stuff, again, trying to remember just in terms of general on special effects. I mean, you know, you put, like I said, they might have also had, they could have done a model and had it in water, too. There's a whole different, whole load of ways you could accomplish something without CGI.
Interesting.
Might have been a model in water, because they had to have that, the tentacles had to sort of float, and that's difficult to do with stop motion. And again, they didn't have CGI.
Nope, not then they didn't.
Yeah, no. You go back to older movies or I feel like it was the Superman, Adventures of Superman, but usually you had a close up on George Reeves. But they would do cartoons. Like you say, nowadays it's CGI, but they would do cartoons of, let's say, Superman flying or something like that. I mean, boy, now I'm, again, here we are making, now we're making a sharp left, is that Ray Harryhausen. I mean, he was the father of stop motion. He did King Kong and all, Jason and the Argonauts, and you know the skeleton soldiers, and
oh, the skeleton,
I mean, what that
so
man
awesome.
Created.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, without
awesome.
Ray Harryhausen, we maybe it would have been longer to work our way up to CGI. I mean, he created such great special effects.
Absolutely. And now, Leslie, to try to get back on track here, we did see for the first time on TNG, we actually saw Ferengi on Next Generation before they became a mainstay on Deep Space Nine. But the Ferengi we see on TNG are a little different than the ones we would eventually see on DS9.
Yeah, I thought they were... What I remember of the Ferengis on Next Generation, even though they, you know, I don't think the makeup changed all that much from Next Generation to Deep Space Nine, but I'll say the intelligence or the intellect, or, you know, I just remember them being these kind of little savages, little people, you know, like almost... in Lord of the Rings, you know, precious, this is my precious, you know, the ring.
Yeah, I would agree with that completely. They were just
the other commentary you could make about them in the Next Generation is that my understanding of is that they were almost comic relief. They weren't really put in to be serious villains. They were meant to be sort of comical. They were meant to be sort of like little midgets. You know, that was what they originally started out as, and it didn't really evolve into being more serious until you got to DS9.
Yeah, because you're thinking, how could a race this idiotic be in outer space and be this dumb? I mean, they were just... I don't know. They just, they didn't work at first, but I'm glad that they didn't abandon them, because the whole Quark, Rom, Nog, Grand Nagus, Moogie thing, it, for me, is one of the highlights of Deep Space Nine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Moogie.
Here, let Mama feed you. Okay.
Oh yeah, we could do a whole show just on the Ferengi if we wanted to.
Well, that's so, you know, it's maybe this would be a show, is like actors that are so famous in one role, it's not a good idea to put them in another role, because when you hear their voice, like the Grand Nagus, I think of Princess Bride.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now,
same person.
I've never seen that movie. Never.
You never seen Princess
oh
Bride?
My
oh,
God.
Stop it. Stop it.
And, no, I've jumped back and kissed myself. That's the truth. I've never seen that movie. Everyone talks about it and tells me I've got to see it. I never have. And everybody tells me when they see the Grand Nagus, they expect them to say, inconceivable. And I'm like,
right, exactly.
Inconceivable? Grand Nagus never said that. I don't catch the reference. I never saw the movie. Maybe I ought to put that on my bucket list.
Yeah, you gotta watch Princess Bride. That's an amazing movie. Or
probably
it's a
one
cute
of Billy
movie.
Best roles in the Princess Bride. Yes, I mean, you know.
Yeah, Grand Nagus Zek. Oh, speaking, I'm gonna make a 90-degree downward swing here for a second because I learned something that I have seen the movie The Howling 100 billion million times. That and American Werewolf in London are two of my favorite horror movies from the 80s. And I went to a convention and I met Belinda Belinsky, who starred in that movie, and had her sign a Howling poster for me. And I was so ecstatic that I got to meet her. I never, ever, ever knew, ever, who played the bad guy in that movie. Do you guys know who it was?
No.
Obviously, nope. It has something to do with Star Trek, or I wouldn't have brought it up.
Well,
right.
Yeah.
But so I'm reading the credits because we're up at camp last weekend and it rained, and so I put that on and I have it as a double feature: first The Howling and then American Werewolf in London on the DVD. So I'm watching it through, and I see on there that Eddie Quist, the werewolf that goes on the killing spree and kills all these people in The Howling, was played by none other than Robert Picardo. And I'm thinking,
oh, really?
that can't be him. There's no way. I've seen this movie a million times. If that was the doctor, I would have known. Well, lo and behold, I went to his IMDb page and I looked it up, and I was like, I can't believe it. I learned something new. The doctor was actually a werewolf eating people in The Howling. And you can't even, the makeup is so incredible, you wouldn't even know it. Next time you guys watch The Howling, pay attention, because now that I ruined it for you and told you who the werewolf is, you're going to go and watch it, and then you're going to say, oh,
good,
my God, Uncle
good thing
Jim is
I'm
right.
Not really into horror films.
Yeah. Well, you know, so since we're on that, it's like when the Klingon speaks in, I forget which Star Trek movie it was, but that's Reverend Jim. I'm sorry, man. You know, back then, this is before Back to the Future and all that. You know, it was when Christopher Lloyd was on Taxi. So when this Klingon speaks, it's like, why is Reverend Jim a Klingon? or you know, I'm sorry, I'll always battle this, is Zephyrin Cochran was this very handsome man on TOS, and suddenly then he's Zephyrin Cochran in the movie, and I'm waiting for him to say, that'll do, pig, because he's Dave's dad.
Yep, that's right.
So that's the danger of doing a character too well.
Well, actually, just to sort of get on the topic for just a short period of time, I mean, to a certain extent, although certainly the actors can't say that Star Trek has harmed them in a way, I mean, with all, especially people like Shatner, the problem with most of the Star Trek actors is that's actually why Denise Crosby tried to leave. It's like the Star Trek curse. You do Star Trek and then you virtually don't do anything else. People associate you with that with the franchise so much that it's almost as if, you know, you do Star Trek and that's all you're going to do other than conventions, because there have been very, very
well,
so circumstances where where actors have translated from it, my understanding is.
I mean, but that's true of any series that, you know, like Adam West to me will always be Batman, Guy Williams, even though I did watch him in Zorro. He's, you know, I forgot the first name, but Robinson, the daddy Robinson in Lost in Space, you know, so, you know, you will have, characters that, you know, if they've been in a series for, let's say, 2, even 3 years, let alone 7 years, Star Trek was 2.5.
Look at Eric Estrada on Chips, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
so
it
happens.
You know, if you're very popular on a series, you basically typecast yourself, and that's what actors are always afraid of, and that's why Will Wheaton, you know, left. That's why Denise Crosby left. You know, they wanted to do bigger and better things, except that they were already, I feel like they were already typecast, that nobody was offering them anything else.
And, you know, I think that, I don't know this because I'm not an actor, I never will be, so I could be talking out of the side of my head right now, but I think that when you create a character that people just love and you do such a good job with that character, you know, like Richie Cunningham from or the Fonz, when an actor is lucky enough to get a role and be able to create a character that becomes so beloved in American pop culture, is that really a curse?
The one actress that sort of came into my brain when I think about this is Candace Bergen with Murphy Brown.
Right.
I mean, she basically eventually wound up having to redo Murphy Brown to get work.
Right. Exactly. That's what
couldn't
I'm saying. Depending on your age, Mary Tyler Moore, you would either know her as Laura Petrie in the Dick Van Dyke Show, or if you're younger, you'd know her as Mary Richards in the Mary Tyler Moore Show. So you know, that's the risk or the blessing, depending on which way you want to look at it, of being in a popular show.
Or what about Christopher Plummer? I mean, Star Trek fans know him as General Chang, but he actually had a more popular role in another movie that we talked about at the top of the show.
Sound of Music.
He was Sound of Music. And, you know, I don't recognize him as from Sound of Music. I'm more of a Chang guy, but he was in Sound of Music. So, anyways.
Yep.
You know what time it is, Leslie?
I know.
Oh?
We've eaten up a whole hour here. But it's been fun. It's been very interesting. I love debate. It, you know, or I learn something too each time.
It's always fun to chat with the Leslie Hoffman, and we go off in such directions, and we talk about the coolest stuff. And it's always so much fun. And I'm glad that you guys out there are listening and joining us, because we couldn't do the show without you guys. And thank you to Ken for hanging out with us and Stunt Trek talking with us. And, of course, thank you to the Leslie Hoffman, because we wouldn't have a show without you, obviously. And as I said, we are on Spotify and iHeartRadio now, so check us out there. Make sure you tune in to Trek Talkin' on Thursday night. And please head on over to the Leslie Hoffman Appreciation Organization Facebook page. Say hello. You know, Leslie checks all her messages over there, and you get a personal response back from Leslie, which is great. And as always, thanks for listening, guys. It's been a lot of fun. We'll be back next Tuesday with another Stunt Trek. I don't know what, but it'll be fun as always. And, you know, as usual, just be good to each other. And we'll see you all next Tuesday, same bat time, same bat channel. We are going to be moving back to Sunday nights as soon as camp closes in October, so stay tuned for that. 10 seconds, and I got to say goodnight. She's telling me 10 seconds to go. Thanks for tuning in, guys. We'll see you next Tuesday. Good night,
hey,
everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.
Let's see what's out there.